And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Machuda.
Welcome, everyone. Greetings. Oh, yes, it's time to enter into the Apologetics Dojo, Virgin Most Powerful Apologetic Zone, if you will. I'm Gary Machuda, your host. Got an awesome show in store for you today. Today, there's a lot of people who have lost their belief in the existence of God. And many times, this is trying to explain and prove the existence of God is something that's difficult to for the average layperson to do, and because we're just not philosophically orientated. Well, I have a guest today who is extremely versed, well-versed in this area. His name is Dr. Edward Faser. He's the author of the book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. And he's going to be coming on after the first break, and we're going to talk about how do you explain, how do you prove that God exists? And it was a great book, so hopefully we'll be able to talk about not only how to explain the existence of God, but also dive into some of his other ideas and his work, his book. It's going to be great. Can't wait to jump into it. As always, we have our sessions for today. Finding the Fallacy for today is the Appeal to the Stone. And the Meet the Early Church Father for today is Fulgentius of Rispa. Fulgentius of Rispa. Not exactly a household name, but a very important theologian who wrote in the 500s. So we're going to find out a little bit about him. And of course, you are part of the program. So if you would like to call in with questions or comments, especially for our guest, Dr. Faser, give us a call toll free at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Or if you would like to email your questions, of course, that will go to the Dojo mailbox. We won't be able to answer that live, but nevertheless, if you have a situation in your life that you're discussing, defending the faith, and would like to share it with people, we've had some awesome emails recently, so it would be great to keep up the trend. Shoot us an email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That's all one word, questions@handsonapologetics.com. And it's also time to give our shout-out to all those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Welcome. Great to see some familiar names there in the chat room. Yes, President Rapsy, I agree. I love Aquinas' proof. But Dr. Faser is actually going to, hopefully he'll show us a couple other proofs that maybe you're not familiar with that are awesome. Just really great stuff. So, before I begin, this is a news article. Excuse me. It's been out for a couple of days, and I've been meaning to share it on the show because whenever something in the news comes on that affects how we can explain defending faith, I always want to bring it up. And this is a news article from the National Catholic Register. It came out on March 4th. Pope Francis orders archives of Pius XII's entire pontificate to be open. Pope Francis ordered the opening of the Vatican secret archives to the entire period of the venerable Pius XII's pontificate, a move that will help shed light on a contentious dispute that the pontificate was either heroically supported the Jews during World War II or did very little. As you know, actually, we haven't talked about that much on this program, but we will. I definitely have to follow it. There's this myth of Hitler's Pope that has been lingering around since the 60s. And it's still out there, although I think it's really been extinguished by some very fine scholarly work, that somehow or other Pope Pius XII was either complicit with the Nazis or he turned a deaf ear to the persecution of the Jews, things like that. And up until its time, the Vatican has released some documents from the pontificate, but not all. And before you start reading conspiracy in that, I mean, this is very normal. It's pretty much any church state or any state has a moratorium on releasing documents just because there might be sensitive information of people who are still living, things like that. But really, this whole Hitler's Pope myth is drawn on hearsay and the lack of evidence. So people, especially those who have defended Pius XII and dismissed this myth, is cheering the Pope's actions to basically open up all the documentation during that period. And people like Ron Rischlak and others hail it. And, of course, you know, hopefully that will dispel, you know, cast away any life that's within this Leviathan that has been around for a few decades. Nevertheless, Ronald Rischlak in this article says that, you know, he's very excited about it and he thinks the information will be basically confirm much of what he's written and others have written. But, you know, as always, when you're dealing with this period of writings, he notes, and I think this is a very astute observation, wartime documents, wartime decisions, it's really easy to second guess, you know, being there in the under the heat of fire, if you will. You know, sometimes things aren't as clear, of course, as hindsight. So he thinks that, you know, there will always be some people who will continue to try to propagate the myth of Hitler's Pope. But nevertheless, I think that's a very good, strong step forward and very helpful for apologetics. So, you know, thank you, Pope Francis, for doing that. So let's jump into our exercises for today. We're finding the fallacy. The fallacy for today is the appeal to the stone. Appeal to the stone is a logical fallacy which consists in dismissing a statement as absurd without giving any proof of its absurdity. Okay, and apparently, you know, it's a weird name, isn't it? It seems that the name came about by an innocent with Samuel Johnson, who encountered the philosophy of a person named Berkeley, where he proposed a immaterialist philosophy, namely that material things don't exist. The only thing that exists is ideas. And Samuel Johnson kicked the stone and said, thus, he is refuted. And this has become known as the fallacy of the appeal to the stone. And basically, why it failed was Johnson, by kicking the stone, tried to show that Berkeley's claim was absurd and therefore really not worthy of consideration or serious consideration, when in fact he didn't refute anything at all. And this is something I think it's a very common fallacy, especially with the advent of new atheism and so on, that the idea that God exists is often brushed off as absurd, yet, you know, very little solid work is done in proving that it's absurd. And even if it is absurd, you still have to deal with the arguments, right? Still got to deal with the arguments. So that's our finding of the fallacy for today. It is the appeal to the stone. And it's time to meet the early church father for today, who is Saint Fulgentius of Ruspe, who was born 467, died 527. Saint Fulgentius was born a son of a wealthy and influential family. He was well educated in Latin and Greek. At one time, he was a tax collector in his native town, but afterwards he became a monk. In around the year 502, he became the bishop of Ruspe. A year later, an Arian Vandal persecution broke out. Now, you remember the Vandals are part of these barbarian tribes, right, that are invading down south into Italy and so on. So this Arian Vandal persecution, he was exiled along with 60 other Catholic bishops to Sarnia. With the exception of a two-year period when he was at Carthage, somewhere between 510 and 517, he remained in Sardinia and until his death, until the death of this Vandal king in 523, in which he returned to Ruspe and lived there until he died January 1st, 527. Fulgentius is properly regarded, according to Jurgens, you know, we're reading from the early church fathers by Jurgens. He's properly regarded as one of the greatest theologians of his age. His doctrine of grace, he followed very closely that of St. Augustine. And in fact, in some ways, he was kind of rigid in that regard. He taught that the particular saving will of God with unconditional predestination to beatitude or damnation. He also believed that unbaptized infants are excluded from the beatitude and that original sin was transmitted because of the concupiscence of the parents. And because of this view, he says some things that could be construed as denying the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Now, in fairness to him, you know, the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, really, it wasn't a point of doctrine. In fact, it really wasn't formally addressed by the early church fathers, you know, during these ages. So, you know, we can give them some wiggle room. You know, it wasn't until later that serious thought and consideration was given to the doctrine. But anyway, he turns out to be a very eloquent speaker, in fact, or writer, I should say. If you ever get a chance, you should check out some of his writings. It's very beautiful. It reminds me a little bit of St. Augustine, although St. Augustine, I think, is much more creative and deep. But nevertheless, St. Fulgentius, very influential. In fact, his influence comes in a little-known council called Second Orange. You might have heard me mention this on this program. Second Orange is a council of the church. It's a local council, but it was approved by the Pope in regards to grace. And there's a few times where they quote him authoritatively in regards to that. And I highly recommend it, especially if there's any non-Catholic listeners who are concerned maybe about the Catholic understanding of justification of faith. In fact, yesterday we were talking to Dr. Douglas Beaumont about that very subject. Look up Second Orange, Google it, and read the canons, and I think you'd be pleasantly surprised at what you see. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to be talking to Dr. Edward Faeser about five proofs for the existence of God. It's going to be a lot of fun. I love his book, and I highly recommend it. So stay tuned. It's going to be a great discussion.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Does God exist? Can you prove that God exists? Well, our next guest is going to help us straighten that out and think clearly in matters of God's existence. He is none other than Dr. Edward Fazer. Dr. Fazer has an associate professor of philosophy at Pasadena City College in Pasadena, California. He has been a visiting assistant professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles and a visiting scholar at the Social Philosophy and Political Center at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. Holds a PhD in philosophy from the University of California at Santa Barbara, an MA in religion from Claremont Graduate School, and a BA in philosophy and religious studies from California State University at Fullerton. Many of you may be familiar with some of his excellent books that he's written, such as The Last Superstition, Aquinas, and, of course, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. Dr. Edward Fazer, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Thank you for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I have to tell you, you have written, I think, one of the best books, at least for a popular level, on explaining the existence of God. I don't think there's another book out there like that.
Well, I really appreciate it. I hope to be able to accomplish several things with the book. And though there's a lot of material in the book that I think experts, academics, and the like would find of interest and useful, I did indeed try to write it so that it would be accessible to someone who is not familiar with philosophy but willing to do a little bit of work. And as I put it in the beginning of the book, though we do end up in some points in the book at the deepest part of the deep end of the pool, I always try to start out at the shallowest part of the shallow end, so as to lead the reader who might be a little bit intimidated by abstract ideas very gently into the arguments.
Yeah, in fact, from what I understand, usually I ask my guests to give a little thumbnail sketch of their journey to the faith. But from what I understand, you know, this kind of reflects your own journey as far as perhaps not believing God exists and then eventually coming to grips with theistic arguments.
It does, yeah. What happened was, you know, I was brought up Catholic, but I fell away from the church in my high school years, and then my early college years, I became an atheist, and I was an atheist for about 10 years, roughly the decade of the 1990s. And the way I finally came back to theism or belief in God in general, and then Catholicism in particular, was late in my career as a graduate student when I was given courses to teach independently in Introduction to Philosophy and a course in Philosophy of Religion. I started to reconsider once again the classic arguments for God's existence, especially the ones given by Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle and the modern German philosopher Leibniz. And it got boring teaching this material to students in a way that reflected the standard atheistic dismissal of the arguments as if they were somehow committing obvious fallacies that a five-year-old kid could point out. So I thought, well, it would be interesting to teach this material to students in a way that made it seem like a real intellectual debate between two intellectually rigorous and serious sides, atheism and theism. So I got back into the writings of people who were influenced by Aquinas and who commented on this stuff, to see how I could beef up the lectures and make the arguments seem more interesting, even if I didn't myself at the time accept them, make them more interesting for students so they could see a real debate. And what happened was, as I got into it, I started to see that a lot of the standard atheist objections were really aimed at caricatures or simplified versions of the arguments, and it rested on really deep misunderstandings. So I gradually went from thinking, well, you know, these arguments are actually a little bit better than they're given credit for, to thinking as the years went on and as I kept teaching this stuff, to thinking, actually, these arguments are kind of interesting philosophically, and they raise some really deep philosophical questions. And that gradually morphed into the conclusion that the arguments had been right all along, and that my own atheism was based on misunderstandings and was philosophically shallow. And so I kind of inadvertently reconverted myself, as it were, to the faith, by way of teaching the material to others and trying to teach it in a fair-minded and sympathetic way.
Yeah. Now, you know, it always struck me that there are some very intelligent people out there, and yet when they approach people of the likes of Aristotle, you know, Plato, Aquinas, and they see something that appears to be something, like you said, like a five-year-old could figure out, don't they, wouldn't the first thought in your head be, wait a second, something's missing here? You know, why are they considered so great if they make such terrible blunders?
Yeah, you would think so. And, you know, I think there are a couple reasons for this. And just to make the discussion concrete, let me give you an example of the kind of misunderstanding I have in mind.
Okay.
Whenever an Aristotle or an Aquinas or a Leibniz or any other philosopher gives an argument for God as first cause of the world, a lot of atheists think, oh, what these guys are saying is everything has a cause, and so the universe must have a cause, namely God. And then the stock response to that is, well, if everything has a cause, then what caused God? And if you say nothing caused God, then why not just say nothing caused the universe? And they think, there, you know, we've just refuted these guys, right? And by an objection that a five-year-old kid could have come up with. But in fact, neither Aristotle nor Aquinas nor Leibniz nor any of these other philosophers of the past, none of them ever gave that argument. That's not their argument. They never say everything has a cause, the universe has a cause. In fact, they would reject the idea that everything has a cause. That's just not a premise in one of their arguments. So, but nevertheless, this objection is just routinely trotted out, both by pop atheist writers and even by sometimes by academic atheists, by professional philosophers who criticize these arguments. So why is that? Part of it has to do with just ignorance. And especially given how hyper-specialized modern academic life is, you know, you could spend your whole life just studying one little sub-discipline within a sub-discipline within biology or philosophy or chemistry or something. Often, intellectuals don't really know much about philosophy, and they're just relying on popular accounts they've read or a class they took two decades ago in college, and so they kind of parrot these silly objections. That's part of the problem. But another part of the problem, I think, is even worse than that, and that is that some atheists and skeptics have so fallen in love with the idea that religion is irrational and that it's got nothing serious to be said for it, that they're very emotionally attached to the idea that you can refute arguments for God's existence in this simple 5-second way. So even when you point out that their objections rest on misunderstandings, they're very reluctant to give up the objections, because then they would have to admit that maybe religion's a more serious thing intellectually than they wanted to give it credit for. They've already kind of committed themselves emotionally to the idea that anyone who's religious is a fool and uneducated, and that they themselves, the skeptics or atheists themselves, are intellectually superior. So they kind of dig themselves into kind of an intellectual and really emotional hole by getting attached to these simple-minded objections.
Yeah, well, it's a lot of fun, I suppose, being able to punch the daylights out of a straw man, you know? And
it really is, yeah. And you know, I'm a blogger as well as an academic philosopher and a writer, and so you know, when you're engaging with people online, it can be depressing how, no matter how polite you try to be, no matter how careful you try to be, no matter how thorough you try to be, there's a certain kind of reader who just couldn't care less about any of that. He's got his talking points, he wants to fling them at you, and he will often do so not realizing that you've already answered his objections before he even raises them. He can't even hear what you're saying. He just wants to trot out his stock objections to religion.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? And to your credit, I'm a research nerd, so I really appreciate this. Not only did you expose that the false premise that everything has to have a cause, but you actually dug down historically to the roots of where that misunderstanding came. So, you know, you definitely deserve kudos for, you know, uprooting that problem at its roots.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And the reason I did that, some readers really appreciate that. And I've noticed some readers say, well, you know, you're right, Fazer, the objection's pretty lame. So why did you devote several pages to examining the historical origins of it? But the reason I did is precisely because no matter how many times you point out that the objection is directed at a caricature, there are still people who just reflexively fall into raising it. And so it could be useful for them to see why anybody would have fallen into it in the first place. As I was, you know, working on the book, or as I've, you know, I've actually been working on this material for quite a while, at some point I was reading an old Catholic philosophy manual from about, gee, it could be a century ago now. It's, you know, early 20th century. And it was actually a logic textbook, and the writer was raising this question of whether philosophers like Thomas Aquinas are committed to the idea that, quote, everything has a cause, and based their arguments on that. And he complained, this is again about a century ago, that was a straw man, they never said that, why do people keep attacking this? And I thought, wow, this guy 100 years ago was raising the same complaint that I'm raising in my own book. It's like the straw man that will not die. You know, it's a zombie objection. No matter how many times you shoot it down, it keeps coming back. So I thought it was worthwhile exploring the history of it and why it entered the discussion in the first place and why people seem to just keep falling into raising silly objections like that over and over.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, thank you so much for doing that, because I found that to be really, I think, enlightening. Because if you can find the point of origin, then, you know, then you pretty much refuted it. You know, it's not, obviously, there was a mistake made somewhere. We have a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the five proofs for the existence of God. When I saw the title, I was thinking of Aquinas's five ways, but they're not five ways. Which ways do you examine in the book?
Yeah, they're not exactly, there's overlap, but yes, they're not exactly Aquinas' five ways. And in fact, the initial title of the book was going to be Four Proofs, precisely because I didn't want to come across as if I were somehow trying to top Aquinas, you know, which would be impossible. But as I worked on the book, I realized, well, there is this fifth argument I really think needs to be discussed, so I'll just go with Five Proofs. But yeah, they don't correspond exactly to Aquinas' five ways. What they are five arguments, and they're not the only arguments for God's existence that I think are powerful arguments, but they're the ones that I think are the most powerful and the most accessible, say, to a modern audience. And so the first, just to give you kind of a quick one-liner summary of each one, the first is what I call the Aristotelian proof. It goes back to Aristotle, and it starts from the fact that change occurs in the world around us, and Aristotle argues that change always involves the actualization of some potential. Like, you know, when my coffee grows colder, that's because it's hot, but it's potentially cold, and then that potential to be cold gradually is actualized. And he argues that the only way we can make sense of how that's possible is if there's something that changes or moves everything else without itself being changed, what Aristotle calls the unmoved mover of the world. Okay, there's a lot more to it than that, but that's kind of the one-line summary. The second argument is what I call the Neoplatonic argument. And it's associated with ancient Greek philosophers like Plotinus, who was a follower of Plato. And it starts from the fact that things in the world of our experience are made up of parts, and whatever is composed of parts, made up of parts, needs something to cause it, to bring those parts together so that it exists. And this generates a regress of causes, where the only thing that can ultimately end that chain of causes is something that exists in what Plotinus would call an absolutely simple way. Something not made out of parts of any kind at all.
Very good. We'll get to the other proofs. I hear the music coming up. Talking to Dr. Edward Faser about his book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. If you want to stay tuned, this is great stuff. Listen to Hands on Apologetics.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Dr. Ed Fazer about five proofs for the existence of God. And for those just tuning in, Dr. Fazer was just giving us a quick outline of a couple of the proofs, the Aristotelian proof from change, how something changes from potentially to actuality, and ultimately it comes down to a pure act. And then the Neoplatonic proof about composed objects, that there's a more fundamental aspect to it in their parts. And, of course, the parts are also composed of parts. And ultimately you end up with something that is purely simple. And Dr. Fazer, what's the third one that you address?
So the third argument is what I call the Augustinian proof, and it derives from St. Augustine and other writers. And Augustine argues that there's certain truths about the world that are necessary truths. Not only are they true, they could not have not been true. Mathematics provides the stock examples of this, that 2 and 2 make 4, that 10 times 10 equals 100, and so forth, are not only true, but could not have been otherwise. And so the idea is that these are truths that never begin to be true and never stop being true. They just are true in an absolutely necessary way. But truth can only exist relative to some mind or other, some intellect which grasps truth. And so these eternal or necessary truths must exist in an eternal necessary mind or intellect, namely the divine mind. Again, that's an argument I develop at length in a whole chapter, but that's kind of the one-line summary of it. Okay. Then you've got the fourth proof, which is I call the Thomistic proof, because it derives from Thomas Aquinas. And Aquinas essentially argues that the things in the world of our experience exist, but they have their existence in a borrowed way. They have to get their existence from something else. It's not built in. And the idea is that whatever has existed, has existence only in this borrowed way, must get its existence from something which has existence in a built-in way, you might say, that doesn't get it from some other thing, but just has it sort of built in. What Aquinas uses the fancy philosophical jargon of something which is subsistent existence itself. It just is pure existence. And he argues that this has to have all the attributes of God. And then the fifth of the five proofs I call the rationalist proof, because it's associated with rationalist philosophers like Leibniz. And it argues that the world of our experience is a world of contingent things. It's things that exist, but their existence is contingent upon or dependent on other things. They exist, but they didn't have to exist. And that the only way to explain how there could be a world of anything, of things like that at all, is if there's something that exists in an absolutely necessary way that could not have not existed. And that we're led to this conclusion unavoidably by what's called the principle of sufficient reason, which tells us that for anything that exists, anything that occurs, there must be some reason or explanation sufficient to account for it, sufficient to explain why it's that way. And that this is a basic assumption underlying all of human rationality, human science. And when we pursue it consistently, we're going to be led to the existence of a divine necessary being that makes it true that there's any world in existence at all. Right. So that in the outline are the five proofs of the title of the book.
Yeah, and boy, I really appreciate it, because, you know, usually Catholics, we focus on the five ways. And it was cool because you exposed me to a couple of proofs that I wasn't familiar with. So thank you for doing that. One thing I also appreciate about your book is I can tell that you have debated, because one of the stock objections to really any of these proofs is, well, yeah, God may exist, but it's nothing like the God that you attribute all these divine attributes to, being eternal and all-powerful and stuff like that. And you devote a whole chapter to that, which I really appreciated.
Yeah, so what I try to do in the book is as I go through each argument chapter by chapter, at the end of each of those chapters, I sketch out how you get from, say, a first cause of the world to something that's all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, there's only one of them, absolutely unique, etc., or how you get from an infinite intellect to something that has all those attributes. But then, as you say, I do devote a separate chapter, which is really, it's long enough to be kind of a book within the book, to exploring the divine attributes at greater length. And as you rightly mentioned, I mean, that is another common objection raised by skeptics and atheists, which is just based on falsehood, which is that, well, even if an Aristotle or an Aquinas or a Leibniz or an Augustine or whoever it is gets you to a first cause of the world, well, they never really explain why we should describe this first cause as God. Why should we attribute to it attributes like being all-powerful, being all-knowing? Why I suppose there's only one of them, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And that's just false. I mean, all these writers actually devote a great deal of argumentation to trying to support that claim. In Aquinas' case, as I point out, he devotes literally hundreds of pages to arguments to show that anything that is the cause of the world, anything that's the cause of there being anything at all, would have to be all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, outside time and space, et cetera, et cetera. Even if someone disagrees with those arguments, the arguments do exist, and a lot of atheists just ignore them. They're not even aware that they exist. So what I try to do in that chapter in the book is to work through all of those divine attributes and explain in detail why a first cause of the world would have to have all of the characteristics that are traditionally definitive of God.
Yeah. In fact, you know, whenever you come to the end of the argument, for example, you know, Aristotle's argument would change, and you come up with a being who is pure act with no potential, you know, I think implicitly in there, you have all the divine attributes. You just have to kind of pull them out. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So the arguments all work up to the existence of something fitting some key description. And in Aristotle's argument, as you say, the idea is that there couldn't be any change in the world at all unless there's something that changes everything without itself being changed, and so something that's purely actual and never goes from potential to actual. It always already is, as it were, purely actual. Okay, that's pretty abstract. But then the idea is, okay, once we get there, we can start unpacking. What would something have to be like if it's purely actual? What does that imply? And among the things you can say about it, you can say a lot of things, as I show in the book, but you can say, okay, wait a sec. If it's purely actual, that means there's no potential in it that could be actualized. That means it can't undergo change of any kind. It also can't have a cause of its own, because the only things that can have a cause are things that have to go from potential to actual. So if it has no potentiality to be actualized, it can't have a cause either. Also, if it's not a changing thing, and material things are always capable of change, they can always, you know, have their parts rearranged, for example, or they can always be knocked out of existence, then this uncaused cause or unchanged changer must not be a material thing. And if it's not changing, and we think of time as the measure of change, then it must not be in time either. It must be outside of time or eternal. And so we go on in this way, and we start unpacking the logical implications of the existence of a first cause who has this key feature. And then you can do that for each of the five proofs. And before you know it, you've got a list of all the divine attributes, and they end up corresponding to the nature of God as traditionally conceived. You're not getting, in other words, just some abstract first cause that has nothing, you know, there's no connection to the God of religious belief.
Yeah, very good. Okay, let me throw a question out at you. This is actually from my friend Joe, who, by the way, is a big fan of yours. And he said, when you have Dr. Fazer on, ask him, if you're sitting across a coffee table with a non-believer, like, what proof would you go to, and is it possible even to explain the existence of God within a couple of minutes?
Well, you know, that really depends on who the non-believer is, because people are coming from all, you know, they're coming from all kinds of points of view. And I would even claim that my book's going to address everybody, because, as I don't need to tell you, some people, their objections to religion don't really have much to do one way or the other with whether they think there's a proof for God's existence. They've got some other objection. They don't like the moral teachings of the Catholic Church or something, or or maybe they've got some, you know, they've suffered some personal trauma that has made them angry at God or what have you. And I don't think that's true of all atheists, but it's true of some of them. And with some of them, you know, giving an argument for God's existence might not address what their problem is, and you might have to approach it some other way. But of course, there are people who, you know, very sincerely, simply aren't convinced that there are good rational grounds, and they're open to hearing them. And so there it depends, I suppose it depends on the particular background and interests of the person you're talking to. In my own case, the arguments that first convinced me when I returned to theism and I sort of worked my way out of the atheism that I'd been committed to for about 10 years were the what I call the Aristotelian proof, which is, of course, also defended by Thomas Aquinas, and what I called the rationalist proof. And the rationalist proof in particular, especially since it rests on this idea that if we pursue consistently the idea that the world is explainable, that it's intelligible, meaning that the human intellect can make sense of it, an assumption that really motivates all of modern science, if we're really deeply committed to this scientific project of making the world intelligible and understanding it, and pursuing explanation to the bottom level, that you're inevitably going to get to something like a divine cause of the world with all the divine attributes. That for someone who's motivated by science and who is open-minded and isn't just an ideologue who's just waiting to try to raise his pet objection, but really wants to understand why he would believe in God, that might be the sort of argument that's best pursued with someone like that, as a kind of opening move, you might say.
So could you walk really quickly through those steps? So you would, you laid the foundation. Where would you move from there?
So the way that philosophers like Leibniz and other rationalists proceed is they start with what I referred to earlier as the principle of sufficient reason. The idea that whatever exists, but could have failed to exist, which is true of everything in the world of our experience, right? Tables, chairs, rocks, trees, these things exist, but they didn't have to. They all had to be made, and they're all contingent in the sense that even once they exist, they're capable of going out of existence. Anything like that, there has to be some explanation of why it does exist since it didn't have to. Or any event that occurs, there has to be some explanation of why it occurred since it could very easily not have occurred. And that science itself really rests on this assumption. When we're doing work in astronomy or chemistry or physics, no scientist would ever take seriously for a moment the suggestion that the phenomenon that he's trying to explain, that, well, maybe it just has no explanation, there's no rhyme or reason to it. So the idea that everything has an explanation can form the starting point of this sort of argument. I hear the music coming up, so maybe we can pursue this after the break.
Yeah, that'll leave a cliffhanger for everybody. Okay, listen to Dr. Edward Fazer. Stay tuned, everyone.
This is Terry Barber inviting you, all the men, to a men's conference June 15th at the Sacred Heart Chapel. This is going to be a day where we're going to talk about true masculinity. You know, there's a problem in the Catholic Church today. We have very few men who love the Catholic faith. And I know a lot of the wives that I'm listening to right now are saying, I want my husband to be on fire for the faith. Send him to the men's conference. Your son, send him to the men's conference by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. That's June 15th. When your husband comes back from this conference, or your son, they're going to have a different view about their Catholic faith, because they're going to meet three men who love Jesus and his bride, the church, and are going to instill in them a love for Christ and his church, the Eucharist, Our Lady. Bring them to virginmostpowerfulradio.org. Sign up there or call 877-526-2151. Full sheen ahead.
It is only because of your continued prayers and generous donations that Virgin Most Powerful Radio can broadcast live each weekday. We count on your spiritual and financial support because you understand the urgent need for Catholic programming that shares the gospel with clarity and charity, but without compromise. Please prayerfully consider becoming a monthly donor. You can set it up with the touch of a button on our website, CatholicRC.org.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking to Dr. Edward Faser, and my listeners know when I get engrossed in the conversation, I lose track of time. So that was entirely my fault. I'm sorry about that. So if you're sitting across the coffee table with a non-believer and you want to explain, you know, the existence of God, you were talking about how things don't necessarily have to exist and that science assumes that there is this sufficient reason for their existence. I think that's essentially where you left off. Am I correct?
Yeah, right. Okay. Right. So the idea is that when, if you pursue that principle consistently, again, philosophers call it the principle of sufficient reason. The idea is that you're going to have to get the existence of something. Think of it as a basement level of reality, a ground floor level of reality that is in no way contingent. It not only exists, but could not have not existed. It's what philosophers call a necessary being. And that when you unpack the idea of a necessary being, you'll find it has got to be outside time and space, non-material, infinite in power, infinite in knowledge, and so forth. Now, as I discuss in the book, the only way really to get around this conclusion is to pull back on the idea that things ultimately have explanations. The way atheists often do this is to say, well, maybe everything in the world of our experience can be explained by reference to laws of chemistry and laws of physics, and then you can take those down to deeper laws of physics, and then you can take it all down to some deepest level of the laws of physics, whatever those turn out to be, maybe string theory or something like that. That's the current popular speculation. But then when you get to the basic laws of physics, maybe those don't have any explanation at all. Maybe they're just what philosophers call brute facts. It's just the way the world is, and we can't make rhyme, or there's no rhyme or reason to it. We can't make sense of it ultimately. So the idea is that we can have, you know, explanations, but not to such an extent that we end up committing ourselves to the existence of God. And as I argue in the book, that's ultimately an unstable position. You really can't make that work coherently. And the way I, you know, one of the analogies I use is that to say that we can explain everything in the world of our experience by reference to laws of physics, and those in terms of deeper laws of physics, and those in terms of some deepest laws, but that when you get to the deepest laws, they have no explanation at all. They're just there without any sort of reason. That's like carefully putting your books on a shelf so that they won't fall to the ground, and then carefully putting the shelf on some brackets so that the shelf doesn't fall to the ground, and then putting the brackets into some rods so that the brackets won't fall. And then instead of putting those rods onto the wall, just letting them go in midair. It's going to take everything down with it. The shelf can't support the books because there's nothing to support the shelf. And in the same way, if you say the basic laws of physics have no explanation at all, they're just brute facts with no intelligibility or no sense to be made of them, then what you thought you were explaining when you were appealing to higher level laws of physics turns out to be an illusion. It's like the shelf that's going to fall down if it's got nothing to support it. So if you're going to be consistent in pursuing explanations, there's no way to avoid the existence of a necessary being who has the divine attributes, who's identical to God.
Yeah. So in a sense, it's kind of an essentially ordered series then, except it's in terms of sufficient reason. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
That's one of the, also a thing you did brilliantly in the book was that, you know, many times some of these proofs will, people say, well, can't you have an affinity of causes that causes other causes? Or in this case, it would be reasons that cause other reasons.
Right.
Could you explain a little bit between an accidental series and an essential?
Yeah. Well, that's I'm actually glad you raised that point because this is another very common misunderstanding of arguments of the kind that I give in the book. People often assume that when an Aristotle or an Aquinas or a Leibniz or whoever it is argues for a first cause, that what they mean is that if we trace the history of the universe back into the past, we'll get to something like the Big Bang, and you got to ask what caused the Big Bang, and then, okay, God caused the Big Bang. And then the atheist says, well, you know, even if we buy that, I mean, so fine, God caused the Big Bang, but, you know, that was 13 billion years ago, and, you know, what have you done for me lately, God? You know, you could always ask that. Maybe he's not even around, right? Or maybe the Big Bang was caused by some earlier universe collapsing in on itself. So why say it's God? The problem with that, though, is that that's not what these guys are doing. That's not what Aristotle or Aquinas or Leibniz are arguing. They're not arguing for a beginning of a series of causes that goes backward into the past, backward in time. Rather, what they're arguing is that for the universe to exist here and now, it's got to rest on a cause that's keeping it in being here and now. And as you mentioned, that's an appeal to what I refer to in the book as an essentially ordered cause and effect series, or a hierarchical cause and effect series, as opposed to a linear series that extends forward and backward in time. It's rather one that extends downward here and now. And just like, you know, your computer rests on your desk and your desk rests on the floor, and the floor rests on the earth, the idea is that what exists here and now, even if it depends on other things going on here and now, like the molecular structure of an object and the atomic structure of the molecules, we've got a kind of pancake structure to reality where the lowest pancake has to rest on something outside the series, or it wouldn't be held up at all. Same thing's true of the existence of the world here and now. The idea is that there must be a divine first cause here and now, who's keeping it in existence here and now. And that would be true however old the universe is. So the age of the universe and the Big Bang and all that kind of stuff just has nothing to do one way or the other with arguing for God's existence in the view of people like Aristotle, Aquinas, Leibniz, and the other people I talk about in the book.
Yeah, so it because it's a continual causal thing that's going on, so that if the first cause ceases, all the other secondary causes cease as well. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. So in this hierarchical sort of series of causes, everything other than the first cause depends on it for its ability to do anything. And an example Aquinas uses is the hand that pushes a stick that pushes a stone. The stick really pushes the stone, but it's got no power to do it other than the power it borrows from the hand. It's really an instrument of the hand. And that's what's called an essentially ordered series, where the other causes in the series depend essentially for their ability to do things, to cause other things, on the operation of the first cause. The stick can't do anything without the hand, and in the same way, nothing could exist here and now, even for an instant, without the bottom level of reality holding it all up, namely something that exists in an absolutely necessary way.
Yeah, very good. So another way, let me throw this out at you. This is one thing I've noticed, that I found that imagination often gets in the way of these proofs, because people try to picture with imagination an infinite series or something like that. What's the best way to avoid that?
Well, an example I like to use, or a parallel, is mathematics. Sometimes people are inclined to think that a number is a physical object, right? They think, yeah, like the number 3 looks like this squiggly little thing, right? But of course, when you think about it, even for a moment, you can see that's not the number 3, the thing you write down on paper, any more than the Roman numeral 3 is the number 3, or any more than the word 3 written out with letters, T-H-R-E-E is the number 3. Those are really just symbols we use to talk about things like numbers. A number is really an abstract object. It's not a physical object. You can't see, hear, taste, touch, or smell the number 3, though you can refer to it with a symbol. And if you were to think of numbers as literal physical objects, you'd be led to absurd conclusions, right? You might think that, gee, maybe terrorists could steal the number 3 and blow it up, and then we can never count past 2. You know, well, that's silly, right? Everybody knows that's silly. And yet when a lot of people think about God, they start thinking of God, they start trying to imagine him literally, right? They start trying to think of some kind of grand physical object, either as the old man with the white beard, or maybe something a little more rarefied than that. You know, they think of God as like the sun, or like a bright light or something. And those symbols, those metaphors might be useful for some purposes. But literally speaking, you can't imagine God in the sense of forming a mental picture. And so when atheists attack, they like to refer to the religious believer's sky daddy, you know, the daddy in the sky, or they compare him to the flying spaghetti monster, and they attack these really crude, simple-minded caricatures. They're just misunderstanding the very nature of God. You really can grasp God only through abstract thought rather than through mental pictures, just like we do when we do mathematics. We're really just using symbols to represent something you can't literally picture.
Yeah, that's very good. I never thought of that parallel. Let's see. Boy, there's so much I want to ask you. Let's say, I hear that you're coming out with a new book. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yes, it's called Aristotle's Revenge, and the subtitle is The Metaphysical Foundations of Physical and Biological Science. Okay. And it's essentially a book length. It's very long. It's probably my longest book. It's close to 500 pages. It's a book length treatment of the question of how the basic philosophical concepts you see in Aristotle and pursued, you know, developed further by followers of Aristotle like Thomas Aquinas, how they relate to the findings of modern science. And so I argue in the book that not only has modern science not undermined the basic Aristotle's basic philosophical ideas. Of course, Aristotle was wrong about certain things in physics and biology and so forth, but the fundamental philosophical ideas of Aristotle, not only have they not been refuted by modern science, but the very practice of modern science and some of the findings of modern science, at least in a very general way, actually presuppose the truth of these Aristotelian ideas, which are ideas that underlie some of the arguments for God's existence that we've been talking about. So this is, you know, in a very brief description, what the book is about. It's officially coming out later this month, so it's already available in Europe, and it's available for pre-order on Amazon.com.
Okay. Who's the publisher?
The Amazon publisher is a German publisher called Editiones Scholasticae. Okay. They publish a lot of academic books and scholastic philosophy. And as I say, it's scheduled to be out by March 22nd here in the United States.
Excellent.
People can pre-order it now on Amazon.com.
Excellent. And where can people go to, keep abreast of all your activities and writings?
Best place is to go to my main website, which is edwardfaser.com. My last name is F-E-S-E-R, so it's edwardfaser.com. It's got information about my books, articles, speaking engagements, and a link to my blog, which I update pretty regularly, at least once a week, sometimes more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great blog, by the way. Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on the program. I appreciate it.
Great to be on. Thank you very much.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's Dr. Edward Faser. And check out his blog site at edwardfaser.com. It's a tremendous blog site. And also, he has some great books, like I said. Not only the Five Proofs for the Existence of God, but he also has a great book on Aquinas and also Last Superstition. It's going to be a classic. All right, so coming up next week, boy, this week was awesome. Great guest next week looks just as good, if you can believe it. We're going to have Roy Showman, Dale Elquist, Dr. Stacy Trisekos, and Dr. John Bergsma is going to be coming into the dojo to share their wisdom with us. And it's time for me to turn off the lights here at the Hands-On Apologetics Midwest Command Center. Turn off the dojo lights. Coming up next, high-intensity Catholic Talk Radio coming at you at the Terry and Jesse Show. Don't want to miss it. And, this week has just flown. Thank you so much for listening to the program. I appreciate your prayers and appreciate your support of Virgin Most Powerful Radio, by the way. Hope everybody has a blessed weekend. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.